Serve It Cold, Episode 20. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
So last Sunday, I blew out the sole on the left one so bad, I don't have to bend over to pick up loose change anymore. And now I gotta break in a whole new pair. I'm not exactly looking forward to the inevitable blisters, but hey, no pain, no gain. So, I'm thinking we should meet at the Arnold Line trailhead a little early tonight. You didn't hear? The cops were all over the park, picking through the trash pile and wandering up and down the trail. I thought for sure they were finally doing something about the dope dealers. A couple of them were taking a real close look at the dealer's favorite parking space. You know, the one over behind the bush, smack in the middle of that puddle with ambitions to Lakehood? Well, I knew your eyes were going, Kenny, but I didn't think they were that bad. You haven't noticed there are drugs all over the park? Jesus! I'm telling you, between the drug deals and the murders, the neighborhood is going to hell, and it doesn't need a ride in a handbasket. No, Eugene said the cops found a gun somewhere on the trail. Really, Kenny? I've got no idea. I must be the only adult male in the county that doesn't own a gun. Why don't you ask your nephew? Isn't he a crime scene tech or some such? Dollars to donuts. It's got to be tied up with the Grantham shooting. I say, sure, c'est la femme. There's always a woman involved. So, anyway, you want to get started early in case the cops do something stupid, like close down the trail? Okay, I'll meet you there.
Way back in the last century, when I was too young to grow a beard, but old enough to stay out late and get in trouble, Catherine was home to a phenomenon known as the 2 o'clock running club, as in, 2 in the morning. It was always an eerie feeling to be out on your own in the wee hours, perhaps coming from or going to some place you knew you shouldn't be, and hear that rhythmic huffing and grunting beast as the 2 o'clockers grimly snaked through the sleeping town. Over the years, the club sputtered, died, revived, and sputtered again, but the original core of founding members remained dedicated to the road. By now, the 2 o'clock running club has morphed into the 7 o'clock jogging club, as in 7 in the evening, and these nights their route starts and ends on the Lamar Park walking trail, and is mostly confined to that neighborhood, which is now home to many of the group. On this particular evening, Catherine was blessed with a spectacular sunset. High cumulus clouds reflected shafts of light down on the town, giving the very air a thick, burnished yellow tone. My merry band and I were driving through this surreal sponge headed south. Meanwhile, back on Lake Shady, Gojo and Lurker had forgotten fishing and were both snapping shots of the Grantham sunset show. But this time one of the stars didn't make the curtain call. Latimer was absent. However, the assembled fans were not disappointed. Latimer's stand-in was none other than the lovely Cindy Altman. Those last few pictures that Gojo took are truly amazing, the glowing light turning the entwined women into an erotic Maxfield Parrish tableau. 6 miles away in Lamar Park, Butch and Eaton had finally been given access to the crime scene. While Eaton played crime scene investigator, Butch slowly searched for clues in the failing light along the section of trail that led from Landis Grantham's house to the walking track trailhead. As he came to the trailhead, he was surprised to find a yellow Porsche parked right in the mud puddle. And across the street from the trailhead, the gathering jogging club members were busy stretching and catching up. Of course, the murder in their neighborhood was a hot topic of conversation that evening, so it must have been like seeing a ghost when someone spotted Latimer Grantham crossing the street toward them. The chatter stopped dead. They all watched in silence while Latimer veered across the track to a picnic table, reached under it and pulled out a bag that had been taped to the bottom side of the tabletop. If he noticed the small crowd watching him, he didn't show it, but turned and headed back toward the trailhead. He never made it. a dark-colored Dodge Stratus came roaring out of the thickening shadows. Latimer had not quite entered the street, but the Dodge flashed across the walking track and hit him dead center anyway. 21 witnesses said that he didn't even try to get out of the way, just stood there and watched it come. The car fishtailed through the freshly planted display of fall chrysanthemums and ran over the broken body again on its way back to the street. Officer Butch Ellis witnessed this second impact from the trailhead, standing in a shooting stance, gun raised. But he didn't dare shoot with the jogging club and a peaceful neighborhood in his line of fire. All 22 witnesses agreed that there were two people in the Stratus. The license plate light had been broken out, but Butch already knew the license number. He was the first person to reach Latimer. There were no signs of life. The plastic bag had been split open by the impact, contents scattered across the body. Butch leaned close and saw firsthand the bright green and purple mottling of SOG Blueberry, red stamens glistening in the golden gloom. Later, Butch would maintain that he didn't call me that night because he knew I needed some downtime. Very considerate of Officer Ellis. I think he didn't call because, one, he was convinced that Latimer's death meant that I didn't know what the hell was going on, which was obviously true. And two, he didn't want me in town blundering around and getting in the way of an investigation that he and Eaton were now officially heading. Me. Getting in the way. How little faith. Regardless, the result of Butch's small betrayal was that we had a very nice, low-stress stretch of quarter time. For Vera and me, it was very much a homecoming. We celebrated by heading to my favorite restaurant in the world, Hey Paul's Louisiana Kitchen. We had scored an 8-top by cell phone on the way down, so we had the two Tommies, Sam and Ken, meet us at the restaurant. We all shared wave after wave of incredible food, us old fogies delighting in Narlene's reaction to Chef Paul's Cajun inventions. Vera really hit it off with Sam and Ken, and soon we were telling Big John stories as the evening slipped by. Suddenly, I looked up to find that we were the only patrons left in the restaurant. I realized then that we had just passed a good time for 2 whole hours without talking about or even thinking about the Granthams and their deadly soap opera. We took pity on the staff and shifted the party 2 blocks over to the Tommy's living room. While Tommy regaled Vera with unique features of the Emil J. Padar barber's chair, the rest of us piled into the kitchen to check out the 8 shallow, flower-shaped ramekins of black raspberry creme brulee that Tommy, too, had just whipped up after I called him from the road. Through some subtle maneuvering on my part, I managed to wrest control of the Tommy's professional chef's blowtorch and lost myself in scorching layers of superfine sugar into 8 perfect brulee glazes, while the crowd moved on to the art tour. There's just nothing like playing with fire. We all gathered again around the big antique cherry table to watch Tommy II pour the perfect complement to the dessert, a 10-year-old Buell Madeira from Cossart Gordon. It was a bit of a step up from the usual Oreos and store-brand sherry sack served at our house. After a requisite period of silence, punctuated by various mmms and ahs, we all gradually lifted our heads from the delicate custards and realized that we were still in the company of other people. Sam, obviously tired of sitting on his hands, finally took the bull by the horns.
"Johnny, tell us, how is this murder investigation of yours going?"
Just as I was about to answer, my cell started thumping in my pocket. I excused myself from the table, asking the rest of the Catherine contingent to fill the others in on the events taking place up north, and stepped out onto the balcony to answer. I was expecting it to be Butch. I was wrong. Gojo's voice came in loud and excited.
"See, it's hitting the fan up here. I think Latimer's gone and got his self run over big time."
The "his self" worried me. For Gojo Jackson to slide into crosstown vernacular unintentionally meant that he was really rattled. "Okay, calm down a bit, Gojo. What do you mean you think that Latimer got run over?"
"Well, I tell you, ain't nobody official knowing nothing, and they telling even less, boss man."
That string of intentional dialect gave me a little comfort. He was calming down. Gojo continued.
"And nobody includes our own Officer Friendly, who's not answering his cell phone, which, by the way, makes him just like you. You are the one who told me to report in when we got home. What's up with that, see?"
"Sorry, I turned it off for a while. I was at K. Paul's."
"Oh, like that makes me feel better. That's cold, see? In fact, that's just plain mean. Okay, here's the deal. Latimer was a no-show at sunset, but that artist type, Cindy, showed up. All I've got to say about that, see, is wow times 2. my grandma ever finds out what I've been doing this afternoon, she's going to kill us both. But if this is what surveillance is all about, I'm dropping out of business school tomorrow and buying my own camera. So anyway, by the time we're getting back to the car, there's sirens shooting off all over West Catherine. You could hardly drive down 98 with all the cop cars zooming around. I mean all flavors. City, Lamar County, Hardy County, Highway Patrol, Constable, Fire Marshal, zoom, zoom, zoom. We get to Lamar Park and see that they've got the roadblock up at the main entrance. So of course we circle around and find they've got roadblocks all the way around. But we find some of those runner people they've got out there. You know, those old guys.
Now go, Joe. Be careful who you're calling old here.
Yeah, like I said, those ancient runner people were standing off to the side of one of the roadblocks, complaining that the cops won't let them run tonight. I do some fact-finding, and these are said unofficial but reliable facts. 1. Latimer Grantham got run over right at sunset by a dark sedan. At guess where? At that walking track place where you guys found the gun. 2. The guy turned around and ran over him again. Probably not an accident, huh? 3. A whole bunch of these runner people saw the whole thing, and there was a policeman on the scene when it all went down. 4. General consensus is that Latimer is dead, dead, dead. 5. They're putting roadblocks up everywhere, and they've got an APB out for a blue 2002 Dodge Stratus. What a coincidence. Report respectfully submitted, sir.
Whoa. So it looks like things have been busy up there. So Butch is incommunicado.
Actually, he did leave one message on the machine pre-hit and run. He asked, what kind of donut do you want? He said that Raganet's prints were all over everything. Gun, Pringles cans, the New Orleans car, the car tag on the mechanic's Buick, everything. Also, Raganet has done time for drug trafficking, B&E, and assault. He also said that he was involved in something called a New Orleans honeymoon scheme. You know what that is, C?
Sort of. I've heard the phrase. I'm fuzzy on the details, but I'm pretty sure it involves running over people.
Wouldn't you know it? Boss, I think we're getting pretty good about figuring out what already happened. We're just damn sorry I'm predicting the future. Maybe we ought to become historians.
You might be right there, Joe. Remind me to look into that. Are you guys working on the stuff to give Butch in the morning?
Sure. Lurker's just finishing up.
Great. When Butch comes by to pick it up, tell him to give me a call since his cell phone seems to be broken. After telling Gojo to be careful about 5 different ways, I returned to the table to find Narlene and Sonny recounting the story of the day's events and telling how they all pointed to Latimer as the mastermind of his brother's murder. Sonny, who had napped on the way down, was really feeling better. He was now more animated than I had yet seen in our brief acquaintance. I know I should have stopped them short with the latest news, but I couldn't help myself. After all, you can't waste opportunities for your new friends to hear about what a good detective you are. And it is always good to sit quietly and listen to partners review a case you're working on. It's a good tool for seeing new perspectives. Yeah, right. I noticed that Vera wasn't joining in on the story and glanced over to find her trying to do her Vulcan mind-meld trick by reading my eyes. I quickly looked down and concentrated on attacking my creme brulee. Soon the story coasted to a stop, and the silence that followed was mine to break. Tommy, too. Are these ramekins painted as black raspberry blossoms? This is just too. It has to be the pinnacle of vertical dessert integration or something. Tommy Two blushed.
Lil John, I knew you would notice. They're actually blackberry blossoms, but they would probably look the same, wouldn't they? There's a new potter in Bay St. Louis throwing them. We're going to sell some in NOLA USA.
While everyone else oohed and aahed over the beautiful flowers that they were gradually uncovering, I took another minute to try to get my mind around Gojo's news. The minute didn't help, so I sent up a flare for help. Sam, do you know what the New Orleans honeymoon scheme is all about? I seem to remember it being one of the Dixie Mafia's deals.
That's right. They played that game. But the Dixie Mafia didn't have a monopoly on it. In fact, I've heard Big John say that some form of the honeymoon scheme has been part of New Orleans for at least 200 years, if not longer. Somebody makes a movie with the plot about every other year. But Ken probably knows the ins and outs better than I do. He's chased several honeymoon skips.
Ken took the handoff.
It's simple. Some guy woos and marries a woman, takes her to New Orleans for the honeymoon. She gets run over crossing the street while the husband looks on. The Dixie Mafia have streamlined and refined this process. They find and recruit con men to be husbands, usually through blackmail and intimidation. These are the guys I have chased. And they are, without exception, scared as hell. I'll tell you about one of them. Roman Keel. Everybody called him Rome. He was a small-time con man and a big-time poker player. The man really could play poker, and I had seen him around both here and in Houston for years. He was a good-looking guy and was always running some kind of angle, just like 1,000 other guys you meet. He always had a fancy watch to sell, an angle on a get-rich-quick deal. You know the type. Rome was a ladies' man who liked having a beautiful woman on his arm, especially if she was willing to pick up the tab, freeing up his money for the poker games. Rome really blossomed when gambling was legalized on the Mississippi coast. He did well, and a good deal of the money he won from heavy hitters in the Dixie Mafia. They couldn't beat him at poker, but they could set him up. He met a horse trainer in a poker game who sold him a tip on a sure winner for a marker. The horse came in as advertised, and so did the next one. Like any other dupe, this professional gambler who had never even been to a horse race put up everything he owned, plus quite a bit more on the third horse, which, of course, didn't even finish the race. One nightmare and two broken fingers later, Rome wakes up to find himself a partner in a new travel agency in Biloxi with a man who liked to be called Cooter and married to a rich, childless widow from Mobile. They honeymooned in Las Vegas, not New Orleans, but 6 months later they attended one of the many grand openings we've had here for that damned casino at the foot of Canal, and the new Mrs. Keel was struck and killed by a speeding car while the couple crossed Julia Street. What was unusual about this case is that the police actually caught the guy. There just happened to be a patrol car turning onto Julian when the thing went down. The driver took a wrong turn, and they cornered him in a dead-end street. Now, when they got to the car, this guy had literally doused himself with whiskey and was chugging on a quart bottle for all he was worth. They said he was clear-eyed and sober when he refused to take a breathalyzer test. By the time they did the blood test at the station, he was as drunk as Cooter Brown. And speaking of Cooter, he was at Rome's arraignment to drive him back to Biloxi. He paid the bail bondsman with a cashier's check that had been made out before Rome's arrest. The only reason they arrested him in the first place was because the whole thing stunk like a honeymoon scheme. They really didn't have any hope of convicting Rome, especially since the car actually hit him, too. He got away with a broken nose and a broken collarbone, and bruised kidneys. The bruised kidneys proved to be a godsend. He convinced Cooter that if they didn't stop in Slidell, that the leather seats in Cooter's new caddy would be covered with pee. He went into the truck stop and caught a ride while Cooter was pumping gas. I found him a week later in a poker game in Galveston. Hard to hide a poker player with a purple nose and one arm in a sling.
Ken took a sip of Madeira and settled back in his chair.
And?
And what?
And what happened to Rome? Did the Dixie Mafia grind him up for a shark chum? Did he become king of Atu Atu? Ken, if you're going to tell stories in this family, you're going to have to supply some resolution.
There was general nodding of heads around the table.
Oh, that and. I apologize. No, Rome might be unique among all of my skips. He actually took my advice and really did change his life. He went back and refused a second chance at bail. He requested solitary confinement and sat in the Orleans Parish Jail until the grand jury refused to indict for lack of evidence. He cashed in the insurance and the inheritance and gave all of that money to Cooter and the boys in return for full ownership of the business. Then he turned it into an actual travel agency. He specializes in selling casino junkets to Chicago-area businessmen and their families. He married his receptionist last year. He's not rich, but he's making a living, and I think the big boys will let him be. Is that enough resolution?
Yes, that's much better. It's nice to know a cold-blooded murderer can evade both the law and the Dixie Mafia to live happily ever after in South Mississippi.
Oh, Rome swore that he never had an inkling of the murder. He thought that Cooter just wanted access to the good widow's money. I'll say that he was very convincing. Of course, he was also very convincing about that $40 Rolex he sold me.
When the laughter had died down, I spoke up. Thanks, Ken. The reason I asked is that I just got a message from Butch that our boy Rayford Raganet has been involved in a New Orleans honeymoon scheme. I don't know what that means yet. I haven't talked directly to Butch, but the message also said that Raganet's prints were all over practically everything they dusted today, including the Pringles cans and the gun.
Great. That means we were right on target.
Well, before we start congratulating each other for solving Landis's murder, y'all need to hear the other news I just got from Gojo. There's nothing official yet, but it looks like Latimer Grantham was struck and killed by a blue Dodge Stratus at that little park close to where Sonny found the gun today. Arlene practically screamed,
"Fuck it!"
which probably surprised everyone else at the table. I, of course, had heard worse from those pretty lips. Vera turned to me and said,
"Okay, Jessica, who done it now?"
"I'll be damned if I know. By the way, if you keep calling me Jessica Fletcher, nobody's ever going to invite us to a party again for fear of rampant murder breaking out."
"Well, honey, I wouldn't expect any invites from the Grantham family as it is."
"Why would Ragnet kill Latimer? It just doesn't make sense."
"Sonny, you're beginning to sound like a cop, always looking for that pesky motive thing." Sam leaned forward and rested his chin on his folded hands.
"Well, I agree with Sonny that we might need to find some plausible motives for the action so far. I've had only an ancillary interest in this case so far, since the hotel may become involved with any litigation, but now, things are getting unpredictable. And since Vera so kindly included Ken and me in this family of friends, I would hate to lose any of you."
"Sam, you need to change that you to us. Remember, there is a wild card in this case. In the first phone call that the fake Landis made, I was warned about another PI working the case. We don't know if this guy really exists or what he's seen. All I know is that if he does exist, I haven't been able to spot him."
"Maybe your problem is that you've been looking for a him. What if the detective is a woman?"
"Vera, you should know that I always look at every woman, detective or not."
"True. So if Ragnet has been involved with the Dixie Mafia, could they be paying him to kill the Grantham clan?"
Sam brought us back to the task at hand.
"Motive?"
"Well, we know that Ray and Latimer Grantham both have access to this super pot. Maybe that's coming from the Dixie Mafia and the Granthams have double-crossed them somehow."
"Maybe. But I'm firmly convinced that it was Latimer that set me up to document his alibi for Landis's murder. Those two were just way too accommodating for anything else to make sense. Could Ragnet have killed Latimer for non-payment? If he did, that means Lily may be in danger."
"You said that the police found Ragnet's fingerprints on the gun in the stolen car, and Sonny said he found the gun lying in the middle of a walking trail, right? Maybe Latimer was setting up Ragnet to take the fall for Landis's murder, and Ragnet found out about it. Wouldn't that be plenty of motive?"
This new angle was met with great enthusiasm, and we poked and prodded at it for another half hour before winding down with Ken's announcement that he had to catch an early shuttle to Houston. It was time to spend some sleep on the subject. Marlene, of course, had already called dibs on the Rapunzel room. Vera and I showed Sonny to Mick and Patty's apartment before walking back to the royal guest house with Sam. Once we entered the courtyard, Sam instantly was transformed into a butler. We followed him through the small lobby and up to our suite. The suite suitably impressed Vera. After being given the grand tour, she disappeared into the bathroom and, from the sound of things, turned on every available faucet and electrical switch. She has never been able to resist the unpushed button. With Vera occupied, I turned to Sam and handed him my Altoids box, saying, "Sam, since you are the hotel detective, I thought I should turn in this box I found to you." He opened the box to find a book of wrapping papers sitting on the fluffy bed of SOG blueberry marijuana. Even with his butler face on, I could see just an inkling of surprise in Sam's face. He said,
"I'll take care of it right away, sir. But Johnny, are you sure you want to give this away?"
I pulled a slim joint from my pocket and waved it. "This'll be more than enough for us old folks. It's no longer safe for me to be carrying any amount in Catherine for the sake of my credibility and the sheer police harassment angle. And if Vera knew I had kept this much out," I tapped the box, "the police would be the least of my worries. But I was going to ask you about that air filter you mentioned before."
"I took the liberty of putting one into the cabinet right over your coffee pot. I had a hunch it would come in handy. Thanks for the gift. Speaking of carnal vices, I've got a friend who is supposed to bring me a new French absinthe next month. It's made from a recipe developed by a chemist who lives here in New Orleans, Ted Bro. He spent years studying the old methods and has convinced a former absinthe distillery outside of Paris to crank up production under the new European Union free trade regulations. I hear that it's getting rave reviews. It seems that the EU might have some redeeming qualities after all. Why don't you and Vera come down for a reprise of Ken's midnight meal?"
"We'd love to come down, but I wouldn't count on Vera drinking absinthe. I'm going to have a hard enough time convincing her to take a toke from this little thing." Sam left. I set up the air filter, and Vera finally emerged from the waterworks all fresh and pink. Before she could pull out her power book, I showed her the tiny joint. "Come on, baby. Let's see what all the fuss is about."
Johnny Speed, just what are you doing with that? Is that all of it?
Yep, just this one little pin joint.
Pin joint? Now you're an expert on pot smoking? Johnny, you haven't smoked dope in 20 years. Now you want me to smoke it too?
Don't get excited. I think it's incumbent on us as professional investigators to investigate the effects of this drug, which most, if not all, of our suspects are sucking up like vacuums.
Incumbent? How much have you already smoked? You do realize we are in a hotel owned by a whole herd of lawyers who might think it incumbent for them to turn us in for doing drugs on their premises, don't you? And have you forgotten that there is someone killing people, Johnny? You think getting stoned is going to improve your aging reflexes?
Ooh, low blow, Vera. Listen, we've got a French Legionnaire standing guard at the door. The hotel has supplied us with this nice air filter to keep any smoke from escaping the room. It's just a couple of tokes each in this thing. Come on, I really don't think it'll kill us. At least not right away. She looked at me sullenly.
Okay. But I'm telling you now, Johnny Speed, if I find out that you're doing coke, mollies, yellow jackets, or anything else that even looks like speed, you will not have to wait for the stroke, and you won't have to worry about some stranger killing your ass. You got that straight?
Thus are the wages of the past. I said, yes, ma'am, as I struck the match.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where Is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com. We just know you're going to have the munchies any minute now, so just hold on. Michelle Malone has kindly prepared some soul chicken. It is mighty tasty. By the way, check out the feature article on her in the November 2007 edition of Guitar Player magazine. And if you can't find it on the stands, then look for it at Michelle's website. Now make sure you've got plenty of napkins on hand while we serve you up a big plate of soul chicken.
that black jam. Break it up real good. Take it out the backyard, cause we'll need the firewood.